Free love, as if love is anything but free. Man has bought brains, but all the millions in the world have failed to buy love. Man has subdued bodies, but all the power on earth has been unable to subdue love. Man has chained and fettered the spirit, but he has been utterly helpless before love. High on a throne with all the splendor and pomp his gold can command, man is yet poor and desolate. If love passes him by, and if it stays, the poorest hovel is radiant with warmth, with life and color. Thus love has magic power to make of a beggar a king. Yes, love is free if it gives itself unreservedly, abundantly, completely. All the statutes, all the courts in the universe cannot tear it from the soil once love has taken root. If, however, the soil is sterile, how can marriage make it bear fruit? It is like the last desperate struggle of fleeting life against death.
Those words were first delivered to the public by Emma Goldman in 1909, an excerpt from her lecture on love and marriage. Emma Goldman, the prominent anarchist of the early 1900s, was a fiery and outspoken critic of marriage, jealousy, and dependency. But the painful details of her 10-year relationship with Ben Reitman, a gynecologist and advocate for the homeless in Chicago, were carefully evaded when she wrote her autobiography, Living My Life. In 1975, Candace Falk, who was the director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, found hundreds of love letters between Emma Goldman and Ben Reitman. Falk's book, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, unfolds the stormy Goldman-Reitman relationship. How do you think that the persona which is captured in your book compares with the persona projected in her autobiography?
I think that there's a continuity of the passion and the emotion and the woman who struggled to live for her ideal, her vision of anarchism. So in that sense, there's a lot of continuity. But where my book, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, breaks from Emma Goldman's own autobiography is that I tell the story of the torment and the weak points as they related to her public life. And I think that Emma Goldman felt much too vulnerable at the time of writing her autobiography to reveal this part of herself to the public. She had hoped that the autobiography might be her ticket back to the United States after her deportation. She was sensitive about the sexual aspects of her life. She enjoyed reveling in an image of herself as a passionate woman, but I don't think that she felt that the public or even her own sense of herself could handle having some of the inner torment of her love life revealed at that time in history. It's interesting to me that in the letters themselves, there's a lot of self-consciousness that she had as a historical figure, where she did want these letters to be public, but not in the context of her own life while she was alive.
Well, she did say to Sasha and her friends when she was going to write the autobiography that she felt it was very important for her to express those parts of herself. Do you think that perhaps Sasha was an influence in having her editorialize some of the things that she might have included?
I think that he was, in fact, although I'm not sure how much she would have included. I had a wonderful experience in Cuernavaca in 1977, visiting some friends of Emma Goldman's, Molly Steimer and Senya Fleshin, who were also in exile, only they were in exile in Cuernavaca. And they told me that when Emma Goldman came back to France, to Saint-Tropez, to write her autobiography, that they were sitting in a cottage with her by the sea, And she had lots of letters strewn all over the table and wanted to really talk through what her autobiography would be and what it would mean. And Molly Steimer and Senya Flashin and Berkman himself said her autobiography should be a monument to the cause of anarchism and a monument to her own life and contribution to the movement. And people like Ben Reitman should be left out of this book, Ben Reitman being her lover and manager for 10 years and someone who they felt very much disdain for. And one of the more poignant aspects of meeting with Molly Steimer and Senya Flashin was when Molly Steimer said to me, "You know, Emma felt that I never understood her." She said, because at the end, even when the autobiography came out, she felt that Molly Steinberg said to Emma Goldman, "Well, you included too much about your personal life and too much about your love life and not enough about the cause." And Emma said to Molly Steimer, "Molly, you never understood me. You never understood how much my inner life is part of my public life." And so when I met with Molly Steimer, there was a little bit of discomfort at first. Why was I doing the same thing, only stretching it further? But she did acknowledge to me the part of Emma who also wanted this to be revealed.
Well, it seems clear in her autobiography and just in in the book itself that Emma saw an incredible interdependency between her personal life and who she was and her family background, going as far back as that. How does one feed into the other?
Emma Goldman found her own family life quite stifling and really painted in gray tones throughout her life. Her parents had a very loveless marriage in many ways and very turbulent. Her mother was a cold woman to the children at first, and her father also had violent rages. And there was a lot of jealousy and scampering for affection among the siblings and movement from place to place. And her whole image of family was very stifling. And I think that, however, even in her own early life with her family, there were glimmers, there were moments in which she felt something more exalted.
Well, like her sister, Helena. Like,
yeah, like she had her sister Helena, who really gave her the kind of love and attention that she needed. Peasant Petrushka, who worked with her and played with her, worked with family and played with Emma Goldman at an early age. And I should say her mother was quite a public speaker and a representative for many of the Jewish young boys who were being drafted into the army in Russia. She was a spokesperson for having them kept out. Her father also was a minor petty official, and so it wasn't like there was no glimmer of public life in her early life. But I think that she felt in her public life that she was overcoming the narrowness of family and leaving this slavery to the nuclear family to give something to the world at large.
One thing I'm curious about, just by what you're saying, is there's a whole conflation of her political beliefs about the family and the institution of marriage and feelings against that. And that, you know, here in this book is portrayed this intense relationship that she has with this man. However, it seems to me that there's always a way in which she distances herself from him and that she does that in most of her relationships. Do you see that?
Yes, I do. In many ways, I feel like she, like most of us, have their personality and relational personality very much shaped early in life, which is not to say that it can't be changed or modified, but many of the basic patterns in her life, what she talked about herself in her autobiography as a feeling of between two fires around men, both repulsion and attraction, I think was true in many relationships in her, throughout her life, and that she had somewhat of a repetition compulsion, if you can call it that, to repeat the same pattern over and over again, and to feel in many ways like the abused and an abandoned child. And that did repeat itself in her relationships with men and also with some women. And that although she had a tremendous public image and people saw her as almost the lioness of power, and that her own internal sense of herself didn't often match that. But I should say that I think that her issues with intimacy are not alien to anyone who attempts to find love and some kind of consonance and harmony in their life. I think that that's what the appeal of the material is, and of Emma Goldman, through this interpretation of her life, because it rounds her out as a human being. It gives her flesh and blood, and shows that no matter what she was able to give to the world, she wanted very much to have something in her own intimate life that didn't often work for her.
I wonder, I don't know how you felt about this. I know when I kept reading about Ben, I disliked him intensely. I mean, I thought he just seemed incredibly contradictory. He seemed obnoxious. He seemed misogynistic in many ways, even though he sort of purported to be something. How was it for you to write about this him?
Well, it's interesting, because in the beginning I had somewhat of the same feeling. Actually, very early on, I couldn't find letters of his. And so there were all these torrid letters from her to him. When I got to know him through his letters, I began to feel that although he was so much of an outcast in her world and was so vulgar and so outrageous in many ways, that he was able to give something to Emma Goldman that nobody else had given her, which was a real affirmation of herself as a woman. Now, he tormented her as a woman also because of his tremendous obsessions, as he called them, his promiscuity. And he was very crude in many ways and very misogynist in other ways. But he had, I felt towards, well, it wasn't even towards the end, I felt a growing sympathy for him as a person who was limited, but who knew his limitations, and who gave what he could.
How do you think he affirms Emma as a woman? What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, part of it is sexual. He was a gynecologist. I did read hundreds and hundreds of sexual letters, which referred to their oral sexuality, which showed that he really cared very much about that aspect of his life and about women's sexuality. And I think that Emma has one letter to him where she says, Ben, for 38 and a half years, I went through life without knowing this. She says, you opened up the prison gates of my womanhood. And I think that that's really a very basic key to her relationship with Ben Reitman. And I don't know whether any love relationship is completely rational. Certainly on the rational level, her friends in her anarchist circles and the socialist circles were repulsed by Reitman. But who's to explain what one's inner longings are and passions. I also think that he was quite a daredevil and a character in a way that affirmed something of that in Emma Goldman. I should say also that Emma Goldman enjoyed that people didn't like him. That she got something from that, to be defiant even in her own circles about who she loved. It was part of her rebellion on many levels.
Recently, in Mother Jones, there was the review, and then there were letters responding to it, and several people felt that the book was voyeuristic. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say about that? What do you think about that kind of response?
Well, there's a way in which the material itself has a sensational quality to it. And looking at anybody's love letters has an element of voyeurism. But in my heart of hearts, I don't think it's a voyeuristic book. I think that if it were only that, then it would have stopped there. But I came to the material with a certain kind of political understanding and the goal of trying to say something about the ways in which public politics and private politics have certain parallels, something about the plight of women, something about love and anarchy, something about Emma Goldman and making her more human and palatable. And so I think that rather than seeing it as voyeuristic, I think that represents a puritanical, that's a puritanical response. And one in which I think many people feel like, my God, I wouldn't want to have my letters public or identify maybe too much. I think that the issues of in the book touch in many different places, and that it's like a coming out of what people's inner lives are like. This is the story of Emma Goldman's, but I think that there's something to knowing about how someone could live in such tremendous torment and still give something remarkable to the world. I think that that gives a lot of strength to any of us who suffer through our own issues of daily life and love and all these, the underside of anybody's public or work life. And I also think that it's important to think about how much, what our overlay is, how much we expect, how much we understand about human nature and the world in terms of balancing out the depth of our disappointment.
I guess I felt a case history was in front of me, in a sense. I mean, in the same way that one may read Freud or any other psychoanalysis that's presenting a case history, that it gave me that kind of response because of the repetition of the letters to Ben. They portrayed an obsession that was uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, somebody said to me, they said, oh, Candace, in the middle of this book, I suddenly felt like I was in a sticky relationship and it made me uncomfortable. Like, oh, no, that's just what it feels like. I don't want to feel it. And it was interesting to me that many of the men who have reviewed my book have said a little bit too much purple passion here, whereas a lot of the women who have read it have felt a little uncomfortable but somehow took it somewhere because there were so many resonances. Mein Schatz, ach, Graf, bin ich, wo Ketten klingen, Glocken ist mein Ruheplatz. Emma Goldman wrote in 1911 to Ben Reitman, "Lover, hobo, you are like anarchism to me. The more I struggle for it, the further it grows from me. The more I struggle for your love, your devotion, the further away it seems from me. Yet struggle I must, for like liberty, you are the highest goal to me, the most precious treasure, dear, dear Ben." Well, are not all great things merely in the ideal? Thus my ideal of love will die with me, never to be realized. Perhaps it is well it should be so. A nice mess my love for you has made of me, a complete dependent for life's joy on a mere man. I feel like kicking myself all over. Oh, hobo dear, I am an idiot.
Toward the end of the book, you mention how, as Emma became estranged from men, that she started identifying more with feminists.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, it just seems like an incredibly complex feminism that she possessed, if she in fact possessed it. Would you mm-hmm. call her a feminist, and how would you define that as her role, in respect to her role?
Mm-hmm. I would call Emma Goldman a feminist. Although the women of her time thought of her as a man's woman, somebody who was not a suffragist, who was not in any way for any special privileges for women. The Emma Goldman spoke always of a kind of equality, but a heightened humanity of men and women together. The parts of Emma Goldman's public contribution to feminism is that she spoke about issues that were very much just below the surface in a very repressive time, a post-Victorian time, just early progressive era, when these issues of love and marriage and jealousy and prostitution and birth control and longings for community and certain kind of freedoms were in the air, but it wasn't exactly being felt in the ways that it seemed to be promised. And Emma Goldman gave voice to very private issues in the public light. And these were issues about women's freedom, about women in the workforce, about wage slavery, that she was able to articulate the discontent and the longing for something other was very important, and I think a tremendous contribution to feminism.
Many of the letters between Emma Goldman and her women friends are contained in Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. Almeda Sperry's letters, however, show a deeper pathos than letters written by other women friends.
Because Almeda was very much in love with Emma Goldman and very much tormented by that and tormented by her own life. She was somebody who was married to a man who was abusive to her. It seems that she was a prostitute as well, and someone who had gotten a sense of respect for herself from a lecture that Emma had given on prostitution, on white slave traffic. And she was just entranced with the fact that Emma Goldman had great affection for her and great sympathy for her situation in life. And I think that Emma was genuinely attracted to and most likely consummated a sexual relationship with Almeda Sperry, although I should say that we have no letters of Emma Goldman's to Almeda Sperry, only Almeda's letters to Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Almeda's letters are sometimes full of longings to hurt Emma,
yeah,
as well. Very graphic images of lashing out at her and hurting the person who she loved. It's a kind of an artifact of one form, one expression of love that love takes.
What would you say are you trying to show the reader?
What I was trying to do in the book was talk about a woman with a vision, and but also many illusions. And the point of the book was not to drop the visions, but to drop the illusions and keep the vision. Like, how do we do that in this world in which one's expectations and hopes so rarely meet what the reality is, and how do you keep struggling for a better world, and how do you keep living your own life and relationships with people and maintain? And I think that there was something very profound to be drawn from Emma Goldman, whose heart and vision and imagination was really so all-encompassing that there's a lot to draw from her on this level after many years of people drawing so much from her on the other level of as the undaunted leader of women.
You've been listening to an interview with Candace Falk, the director of the Emma Goldman Papers and author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. The interview was conducted in 1985.